Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's the most viral time of the year. Winter. It's when we huddle indoors in close quarters, and that makes it easy for viruses to spread. This year, viruses like flu, RSV, and yes, COVID are spreading throughout the state. Washing hands, staying home when sick, and getting vaccinated all help curb the spread of viral illnesses. But despite vaccines being a scientifically proven method of slowing and decreasing, even eradicating, life-threatening diseases, vaccine hesitancy is beginning to have an impact. Diseases that ceased to be a threat are reappearing. And in some cases, even adults who have been previously vaccinated against those diseases may be at risk when they come back. So this hour, a look at the viruses causing problems now and a closer examination of the science behind vaccines and what could happen to public health and that of your family as mis- and disinformation about vaccines continues to spread. Dr. Bonnie Coyle is with us. She is medical director from Mecklenburg County. Dave Westner is professor of biology at Davidson College. And Rose Hoban is founder and editor at North Carolina Health News. And they all join us for the hour. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hey there.
Good morning.
Morning. Dr. Coyle, let me begin with you. This is your first time on the program as Mecklenburg County's health director. I don't know why it's taken us so long to get you on, but we're glad that you're here. According to the CDC, levels of flu are high or very high around the country. RSV is spreading at high levels, and COVID-19 has shot up again in places around the country. What viruses appear to be most prevalent here in Mecklenburg County and the surrounding counties right now this morning?
Right now, RSV is running very high here in Mecklenburg County. It's near more than twice as high as it's been in the past 2 years. Flu is also very high, about the same levels as last year. COVID, as you just mentioned, is a little bit lower, but we are ticking up right now. And a lot of times you see that after the holidays, when people have all gotten together and are indoors quite a bit and to get celebrating in larger groups, we tend to see these upticks coming out of the holiday season.
You know, RSV, I had never heard of that virus until COVID. And all of a sudden, I hear about it all the time, and it seems to be everywhere. But it's clearly, it's been with us for a long time. Why are we just becoming aware of it, the average person?
It's been around for forever. Many, many years. It tends to affect children. And especially infants, very young children, very likely to get pretty sick from it. I think just in general, the focus on respiratory viruses at this time of the year is what sort of brought it into the forefront and making people more aware of it. The whole COVID pandemic has really caused a lot of folks to look at what's happening with viruses and infections in general. But it's been around. It can be particularly dangerous for infants and older immunocompromised individuals. So it is an important one for everybody to be aware of.
I know that we measure the level of COVID by checking the wastewater. That's a good way to check the infections. And I know the next wastewater report on COVID in Mecklenburg County is scheduled to be released tomorrow, I believe it is. So we don't have the current numbers. But how do you measure the rate of infection and what viruses seem to be prevalent in any given area at any given time?
There are a number of different ways that we look at what's happening with viral activity. As you mentioned, wastewater is one of the things that we started doing COVID, which has been a really helpful way for us to get an early sense of what might be starting to spread in our communities so that we can take action. And wastewater levels for COVID specifically have been on the increase. Now, this past week, we did see a little bit of a drop, so we're watching that carefully to see what happens. We also get reports of laboratory reports that show us what viruses might be starting to spread more. And then we do what's called syndromic surveillance. So we are looking at emergency department visits to see what kinds of diseases might be out there based on the symptoms that people are presenting to either for the emergency department visits or being hospitalized.
Rose Hoban is with us. She's the founder and editor of North Carolina Health News. And I know that you have all these dashboards, viral dashboards up in front of you right now, Rose. That's the reporter in you coming out. Let's talk about a virus we haven't mentioned yet this morning that you have say is everywhere right now. And that is something that we always heard about on cruise ships, but now it's a landlubber. Norovirus. What's the situation, Rose, right now with the norovirus?
I've heard norovirus referred to as winter vomiting disease.
Oh, lovely.
Because similarly, everybody is gathered inside. And also, you know, norovirus is reminiscent of RSV. Like, you might not have heard of it, Mike, but that tells me that you don't have any young children. Because if you're the parent of a young child, you know RSV and you mm-hmm. know norovirus, because kids are always touching one another. And norovirus is a highly transmissible enteric gut disease, gut infection that causes, you know, short-term vomiting and diarrhea. It makes you pretty miserable. And then, of course, because you have all this vomiting and diarrhea, it's easy to get on your hands, and then it's easy to spread around, right? You know, in kids, their hands are everywhere, and adults are not so great about washing their hands. And it turns out that in particular, norovirus doesn't really respond as well to all of those, the gels, the alcohol gels that we all got used to using during COVID. You really need to wash your hands well to reduce the norovirus transmission. And that whole thing about like cruise ships, like, you know, people, they have the vomiting, they think maybe they're just seasick, they leave their cabin, they're grabbing on a rail, they leave some norovirus behind, then someone else grabs that rail. You know, that's part of the reason why it spreads so easily on cruise ships. And activity for norovirus is very high. According to the CDC dashboard I'm looking at here, the rates of positive tests for norovirus is, and this is, the data is a little bit old, data always lags, but we're looking at 11.56% of the tests are coming back positive for norovirus in emergency departments around the country. So it's out there, and it is ripping through people. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I've got it's high in North Carolina. It's high in the entire Southeast. We are at the highest level of norovirus transmission right now.
So one of the things that we learned during the height of the COVID pandemic was to wash your hands with soap and water and wash them for at least 30 seconds, and you can sing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star twice, and that's about 30 seconds. So that will work for the COVID virus. Dr. Coyle, flu is usually prevalent. It's certainly prevalent now. And it's kind of hit or miss. It's a guessing game with regard to scientists developing the vaccine for the flu virus every year, which we'll talk about with Dr. Westner in a second. But how did they hit the nail on the head this year? Is the vaccine the right vaccine for this virus?
Yes, it is providing pretty good coverage this year for the viruses that we're seeing. We're seeing like H1N1 and then an H3N2, and those are getting pretty good coverage.
So, Dr. Westner, you're the biologist here. Let's talk about vaccines. The flu vaccine, as I said, is sometimes hit or miss because scientists have to take a guess at what's going to be the dominant strain of the virus that comes to an area near you and make a virus or vaccine, rather, that will keep that virus at bay. The COVID vaccine was formulated completely differently from how we do the flu and other vaccines. And I guess the question is why, and given how effective the COVID vaccines have been and the technology they use to develop them, why haven't we switched the way we do flu?
That's a good question. I think we might see that change. I think the COVID vaccines are a great example of how rapidly that platform can be used to develop a new vaccine. And there's nothing specific about the COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2, that lends itself to an mRNA-based vaccine. So I think it won't be surprising at all if we see vaccines for other viruses being rolled out in the mRNA platform.
Because, as I understand it, we still grow the flu virus in an egg medium, a chicken egg medium. And of course, we have bird flu going around. Will there be enough eggs to continue that practice? Why is it so? I guess the question would be, the COVID vaccine is an mRNA formulation, which people have been working on for years in advance of COVID, which allowed them to put what they already knew to work to develop this vaccine very quickly. Are there other applications in the pipeline right now or that have already been adapted to use that technology going forward?
Oh yeah, I think a lot of researchers are looking at again developing new vaccines that are using that same platform. And getting back to the mRNA vaccines, they were rolled out quickly in response to COVID. But as you mentioned, there's a lot of research that occurred for decades prior to that rollout that really made that advancement possible. I mean, the whole idea about mRNA vaccine is that you're injecting mRNA. That's being converted to a protein that's stimulating the immune system. Now, there's a lot of work looking at how do we make RNA in laboratory? How do we get RNA inside cells? How do we tweak RNA molecules so they're maximally stable and productive? And all of that past research made the development of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines possible in that quick time frame.
These vaccines, are formulated in different ways or have been over time. Some use live virus, some use, I guess, remnants of virus particles, etc. You say you have always been fascinated by viruses because they seem both complex and simple at the same time. And you point out, on the one hand, they have caused immeasurable human suffering, yet in the near future, researchers may be able to use viruses to treat various human diseases. So they are both diseases and drugs? Is that what we're getting at here? Talk about that and about exactly what a virus is. What is it?
So what is it? At a very basic level, a virus is some genetic material, DNA or RNA, that's encapsulated within a protein shell, a capsid of some kind, that allows it to get inside our cells and then replicate. So the viruses are able to replicate only within our cells or within an appropriate host cell. They use the host cell machinery to help them get replicated. And they cause disease primarily because they're then killing the cells that they infect, right? There's been a lot of interesting work lately looking at harnessing that ability of viruses to kill cells in a positive way. So what do I mean by that? There's work ongoing at Duke looking at glioblastoma, a form of brain cancer, really, really horrible form of cancer. But it's been shown by researchers that certain strains of poliovirus, again, we're all familiar with the horrific effects of poliovirus, but certain strains of poliovirus preferentially infect and kill the glioblastoma cells. So potentially that virus could be used as a type of cure. If it can infect the tumor cells and kill them, that could have a real positive outcome. So it is sort of a double-edged sword with the viruses.
I want to come back we have to take a break, but I want to come back in a minute, Rose, and talk about this because Dr. Wessner just said we're all familiar with the effects of polio. And that's because he has gray hair, and so do I. And Bonnie Coyle is a doctor, so she knows. And Rose, I think, I don't want to date you, but I think you're old enough to remember the news about polio, etc. But a lot of people evidently aren't. And there are a lot of vaccine skeptics, which we're going to talk about as we go through the program, who may not be as skeptical if they knew what these vaccines had accomplished over time. So when we come back, we'll talk about that and other aspects of all this as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Bonnie Coyle, Medical Director from Mecklenburg County. Dr. Dave Wessner is Professor of Biology at Davidson College, and Rose Hoban is the founder and editor for NC Health News. We're talking about the prevalence of viral infections sweeping through the community, as they often do in the wintertime. And I want to talk about virus, or I keep getting viruses and vaccines mixed up, I'm sorry, vaccine hesitancy in just a moment. But let me just touch on COVID for a second, because COVID was rampant and killed hundreds of thousands of people around the world not too long ago. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dr. Coyle, but it would still be doing that were it not for the vaccines that were developed, or if enough of us had not developed herd immunity to shut it down. Is that accurate?
Accurate. In fact, it killed millions of people worldwide, and it is because of having vaccines available and people's immunity being built up against it that we have seen dramatic drops. And a lot of people will say, well, the vaccine doesn't work because I got COVID anyway. The really important thing to remember about vaccines is sometimes they won't prevent the disease, but they will prevent the severity of the disease. So both hospitalization from the disease because you got that sick, or actual death from the disease. So it's really important to notice that how much the rates have dropped of COVID and how much that is likely due to the immunity, as you mentioned, the herd immunity that has built up.
So COVID has been tamed mostly by these viruses, but it still causes more hospitalizations and more deaths than the flu or RSV. I take it, Dr. Wessner, we can credit the decline to these vaccines, but those people who are still getting sick, who are still being hospitalized, are they likely to be people who have not been vaccinated? Dr. Wessner.
Yeah, I would say that that's probably true. I don't know the absolute numbers, but I'd say that that's probably true. The vaccines provide a great deal of protection. Now, as Bonnie mentioned, I think when vaccines came out, there was some talk about, well, I got vaccinated, but I still got sick. If you look at the initial human trials, Pfizer, Moderna, they weren't even looking at, do people get infected after getting the vaccine? They were looking at, does this vaccine prevent hospitalization? Does it prevent death? And they're highly successful in that regard. So they're reducing the severity of disease by a large measure.
You recently wrote, Dr. Wessner, an article for Forbes magazine in which you talked about the roots of the COVID-19 virus and its devastating infection rate 5 years ago to where it is today. So where is it today?
It's part of the respiratory illness landscape now. I mean, it's not going away. COVID is going to be a virus that's with us from this point going forward. But we have to think of it now as it's part of that constellation of viruses that cause respiratory illness, with influenza, with RSV, with some other viruses in that category.
I take it then that it's always going to be with us. So how should we regard it? Should we regard this any more seriously today because of the existence of these vaccines than we do the flu? Or could it mutate in some way to become as virulent and dangerous as it once was?
Yes, it could mutate to become more virulent, more transmissible than it currently is. That's certainly a possibility. Viruses mutate all the time. That's sort of what they do. And I think it's important, too, to not get caught in the trap of saying, well, it's just like the flu, because the flu is quite dangerous, too. I mean, we routinely have 20, 30,000 people a year dying of influenza. That's not an insignificant number.
Dr. Coyle, you are nodding vigorously as Dr. Wessner talks about this. You want to join in on this?
Well, I think of Dave's comment a few minutes ago about the viruses being both complex and simple. The complexity of them is their ability to mutate and keep creating variants. I think we've all are aware of with COVID, how many different variants there have been. And so, and that's the same with flu. Flu will mutate each year, as you mentioned. That's why it's a little challenging coming up with the right formula for the vaccine each year. And so we always have to be doing surveillance and seeing what variants are circulating and what mutations are happening so that we can make sure that the vaccines match up with those variants, and also to watch out for the opportunity for a huge outbreak, because if there's a significant mutation, that's what then causes pandemics.
Mm-hmm. Rose.
I wanted to jump in here. You know, I think one of the things that now we all know about variants, right? And all the people on this call are folks who've been trained scientifically. You might remember I'm a nurse, and I have a public health degree. So we all sort of knew about variants and knew about the way that vaccine, now you've got me doing it, Mike.
the
way
contagious.
That viruses, I know, exactly. The way that viruses can evolve and change over time. So we all knew about that, but you know, most of the public didn't. And I think that could have been part of the big mixed stew that has led us to this vaccine hesitancy that we see now, because people were like, wait, I got this shot, but you want me to get another one? Like, what the heck is happening here? You know, like, so I think there was a lot of new information presented to the public very quickly during the pandemic. And one of the things I'm always saying is that public health folks don't do a great job at telling their own story. And so, you know, like all this stuff, all of this, like the research into mRNA that had all been chugging away beneath the surface, and, you know, efforts to vaccinate people had all been chugging away underneath the surface. And now it exploded into consciousness and people were like, wait, what? Like, it's what's all this stuff that's happening? And I think that is a large part of what we're seeing now.
Well, let's talk. It never occurred to me to ask this question until you were talking, Rose. But I know that I got the measles on the polio vaccine twice. Once the Salk shot, and then I once took a sugar cube of the oral vaccine, the Sabin vaccine. Other things, I got one vaccine and I'm set. Then once again, for things like tetanus, you get a shot and you come back for a booster in 5 or 10 years. Why? Why are some things one and done and other vaccines you have to replicate over and over and over, like the COVID? Why?
Oh, probably Dave can talk about
right,
this,
Dave?
But I do have thoughts, but let's let Dave, because he's
okay.
The expert.
Okay.
Short answer, the immune system is really, really complex. Mm-hmm. I think that's the easy answer to it. Mm-hmm. There are some vaccines that give you long-term immunity to certain pathogens, measles, polio, et cetera. For the COVID vaccine, it seems to be really effective, but immunity wanes over time. We've seen that, not just because the virus is changing, but because your immune system's ability to react is decreasing over time after the vaccine. Those are you know, part of the mystery of the immune system, I think.
Mm-hmm. So we have, Rose, that, oh, go ahead.
I was just saying, the immune system is, as Dave said, so complicated, right? So everyone was always talking about antibody levels, right? Well, the energy that your body requires in order to make a lot of antibodies, you know, your body is gonna be efficient, right? And so it's going to make a lot of antibodies when you first get vaccinated, and then those antibodies are going to wane over time. But it's not to say that you don't have immunity, because there's other parts of your immune system, and people may have heard about these B cells, which are out there, and T cells, which are out there, and they're creating vaccine memory. And so when they're seeing a new virus come, you know, approach, like they get busy and they're like, oh, we're going to make more, you know, antibodies again. So it's so complicated. You know, it takes people with PhDs like Dave to figure out what's going on with the immune system. So then we have to transmit that to the general public to help them understand that this is all this stuff that's happening beneath the surface and under your skin and in your spleen. So, you know, that's part of why you had people be like, what's all this stuff that's happening?
So we had all this focus on vaccines being developed quickly, and we had to take them quickly for COVID. And a lot of people who don't follow this because they haven't had to follow this were confused because we were doing this in real time, in full view, and scientists don't know everything all at once, and they learn new things, and that changes what they said before, and that's all very confusing for people who are not scientists, and it leads to some mistrust. But we do have this long-time track record for successful vaccines, which have eradicated polio, which have taken us, nobody gets lockjaw anymore. Rubella, pertussis, those diseases are no longer the concerns they were in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and prior to that. So they have this long-term track record. What is driving, aside from this confusion that happened during COVID, Rose, what is driving this vaccine hesitancy all of a sudden where I'm not getting my kid that shot?
I would disagree that it's all of a sudden. There's been sort of latent vaccine hesitancy perking away again at low
but
levels.
Why?
Well, I mean, because it's mysterious. People don't understand it. There was a Supreme Court case about smallpox vaccines in the early 1910s. And it helped to establish part of the, awesome powers of public health at the time. But, it's a little bit like faith. People don't understand things that they can't see. I'm sitting here looking at, data about poliovirus vaccine, and sometimes people do get sick from getting the vaccine, very rarely. The number that I'm looking at here is that it's something like every birth cohort of 1 million children, there's 2 to 4 cases of vaccine-associated paralytic poliovirus, right? So, so you get these people and those get amplified because, if it bleeds, it leads, that, Mike. So those things get amplified. And then people have forgotten the horror of these childhood vaccines. And I tell people a lot that when I was still practicing nursing and I worked for Doctors Without Borders for a time in a refugee camp, and I would walk through camp and I would literally have mothers grabbing me, like grabbing my clothing and saying, "Can you get my baby vaccinated? Can you get my baby vaccinated?" Because in Indonesia, where I was, they were still seeing these vaccine preventable diseases and they knew the horror of them.
Dr. Coyle, you're on the front lines. You and your staff are on the front lines of this in getting people vaccinated, particularly young children, vaccinated with all the childhood vaccinations that kids have been normally getting through the 20th century and into the 21st. What are you seeing on the front lines? Are there more people who are reluctant, who refuse to get these vaccines?
I'd love to address that question, but if I could just highlight a point that Rose just made. I often think sometimes the success of vaccines have ironically been their downfall. Because again, as you mentioned, folks who are older, like myself, we've seen the diseases, and then we saw the rates drop dramatically. When you look at disease trends for communicable diseases since the early 1900s, they have dropped dramatically. In fact, back in the early 1900s, the number one causes of death in this country were communicable diseases, but that's not the case anymore because of vaccines. But the problem is younger generations just see that, well, these diseases, they don't even exist anymore. And so why should I vaccinate my child? Well, because we need to promote herd immunity so we keep them in check. And so to move on to your next question, and this is very concerning, we are seeing more and more parents decline vaccinations for their children. When we look at as children enter school and how many of them have declined, those numbers are going up. And so that's concerning because we are going to lose. That's when you're going to start to see these diseases reemerge. Pertussis is an excellent example right now. For the
past number of years. That's whooping cough, right?
Whooping cough, yes, sorry. Mm-hmm. Whooping cough, okay. In Met County, we'd only seen a couple of cases a year for the past, you know, for many, many years. This year, we've had over 60 cases. And so then that requires all kinds of additional investigation in the schools. And in many of those cases, the children were either unvaccinated or did not receive the full vaccination series.
So parents are saying no. The New York Times reports that childhood vaccination rates began declining prior to the pandemic, and the pandemic caused them to increase. Although average vaccination rates, they say, remain high, the share of kindergartners vaccinated against measles, polio, chickenpox, and whooping cough, pertussis, have been dropping and creating new pockets of students no longer protected by herd immunity. Yes. I thought that vaccinations were required to get into the schools. Is that not the case in Mecklenburg County?
They are required to enter school. However, you can get an exception. The law does allow for exceptions, and your exception can be for either medical or religious reasons.
And some people, their reason is they want to keep their child safe, so they don't want to infect them or endanger them with these vaccines. Are they keeping their children safe by not getting them vaccinated, or is the opposite true?
I think the absolute opposite is true. The vaccines are what is going to keep our children safe. And it's also going to keep older folks safe, because probably one of the biggest spreads of viral infections to our older population is from, you know, grandchildren and younger kids. So, you know, as I just highlighted with the pertussis example, when kids don't get those vaccines, they're the ones who are getting infected more often when exposed to the viruses.
And for whatever reason,
I think another part of the equation too is that there are some members of the community who can't be vaccinated for various medical reasons. They may be immunocompromised, some other medical reason they can't be vaccinated. They're going to be protected if everyone else is vaccinated. Yes. If we have these pockets of people that are electing not to be vaccinated, then those people who can't be vaccinated are at increased risk.
Better to get herd immunity through vaccination than through a rampant spread of disease like we saw with COVID going through the population. Mm-hmm. We have to take a break. I want to come back and talk about the politicized nature of this and review what the world was like before these vaccinations were everywhere. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about viruses and vaccinations and the vaccines that have put these viruses at bay for decades now, with Dr. Bonnie Coyle, medical director for Mecklenburg County. Dr. David Wessner is professor of biology at Davidson College, and Rose Hoban is the founder of and editor of North Carolina Health News. This, for whatever reason, has become a political issue. I think we know in great degree why it has become a political issue, but we'll let that slide for the time being. But 31% of Republicans now say vaccines are more dangerous than the diseases they were designed to protect. Only 5% of Democrats believe that. This state supported Donald Trump in this last election, so it seems that we would fall into the category where more people believe that these vaccines cause more harm than the good that they do. Is that a concern for you, Dr. Coyle?
Yes, it is a concern because, again, as we've already been talking about, if more and more individuals back away from becoming vaccinated, we're going to see the reemergence and new infections coming up that will put us back so far in terms of our health.
Polio is virtually unheard of in this country today. It used to paralyze 20,000 people a year and killed many of them. And I remember my parents not allowing me to go to the community pool one summer because of fears of the spread of polio. I remember the pictures of children being in iron lungs because polio had deprived them of the ability to breathe on their own. All of this has faded from the public consciousness. Yeah. If modern Americans, Dr. Westner, really knew the impact of polio, the impact of whooping cough, and what that does or can do to young people and other preventable diseases, would they be less likely to be vaccine hesitant? Have we done a good job of reminding people of what no longer exists thanks to these vaccines?
No, we haven't done a good job of that. And I think Bonnie brought that up earlier. I mean, the part of the problem is the success of vaccines. We don't see polio. We rarely see measles. We're in the past now to not see chickenpox anymore with the vaccine that's available. And parents are sort of saying, well, why should I get vaccinated if there's virtually a 0% chance of my child contracting this disease? And yeah, that leaves us in this position now where we have more and more people electing not to get vaccinated, which opens the door for the reintroduction or reemergence of these easily preventable diseases. So yeah, I think it's a good point. I mean, people have forgotten the horrors of some of these diseases.
Rose? And then, you know, there are these diseases that are more benign, like mumps, and people like, or measles, right? Like, people don't understand that when you had large outbreaks of measles, you know, there was some percentage, like something like 5 or 6% of children who would die. And there would be quite a number of those children who would be hospitalized. Yeah. Mumps, you know, oh yeah, you get swollen. But what people don't understand is that for boys in particular, it can lead to sterility down the road, right? German measles, rubella, what they don't understand is that if a pregnant woman gets it, then there's a high likelihood that her baby will be born blind or deaf. We don't see these things. And we kind of see those effects take place at scale, right? Like not, you know, not like when you get like one or two cases, it's when you get, you know, tens or thousands or, you know, of cases. And measles, what we've learned about measles, aside from the fact that it can kill children, is that when you get measles, this is so crazy, it essentially wipes out your immune memory. And it, you know, it sort of like produces this amnesia that, you know, we've kind of like, you know, when you've got a little kid and they go to preschool and they get exposed to all these little viruses and they come home and they're sick. And well, measles would wipe out all of that immune memory if you get it. And so it's one of those effects that now we have a better sense of.
So Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been proposed by Donald Trump to be the next Secretary of Health and Human Services. He is an anti-vaccine advocate. Rose, would his confirmation be seen as giving the anti-vaccination movement credibility?
That's a really hard question. I'm not sure I'm ready to speculate on that, Mike, but what I will say is that, like, there's been fears, like, would he ban vaccines? I don't think he needs to ban vaccines. I think what needs to happen for increasing vaccine hesitancy is introducing that doubt into the ecosystem.
Well, yesterday, right? A national coalition of health professionals and scientists, including faculty members from some of the country's leading academic institutions, including the public health schools at Harvard and Yale, issued a public letter urging senators to reject Robert F. Kennedy Jr. because, quote, he is unqualified to lead the nation's health department, has little to no relevant administrative policy or health experience or expertise, and has unfounded fringe beliefs that could significantly undermine public health practices across the country and around the world. Dr. Coyle, you're in public health. Do you agree?
Yes, I do agree. I think it's it's going to be that much more important for those of us in public health to be providing more education, more appropriate education, just really beating the drum, so to speak, of how important, how valuable, how effective vaccines are right now to try to counteract any of the misinformation that is out there about them being harmful.
And Dr. Westner, as a biologist who's intimately aware of vaccines and how they work and viruses and how they work, what's your take on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead that department?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly problematic. I'm not a policy expert. I can't tell you what he can or cannot do at the federal level. But I can tell you that words matter. And if you have someone in power, someone with the microphone saying that vaccines are dangerous or amplifying false narratives about the vaccines, that's going to be a problem. That is just going to encourage people to believe that, again, that false narrative.
Rose.
And I haven't said, none of us have said the A word, namely autism. You know, one of the things that Kennedy has promoted is this thoroughly debunked, it's proven to be wrong in multiple studies, the millions and millions and millions of dollars that we've spent debunking this lie that was promulgated by a British doctor who's now been stripped of his medical license, and the journal that published the original study has retracted it and apologized for ever publishing it, right? So like, but this lingers on that, you know, these vaccines cause autism, and why is there so much autism? And the president-elect has talked about why is there so much autism? And, you know, I would argue that I have a nephew who was diagnosed with autism in the 90s, and, you know, but he's on the autism spectrum. So, you know, a kid that might have been just seen as maybe weird or, you know, like communicating weirdly or, you know, like it, back in the day, now has this label. So it's, you've had a widening of the diagnostic criteria, right? So there's also this thing that just keeps circulating, this falsehood that just keeps chugging out away.
And to past its prologue, we're about to go through four more years of intense dis and misinformation and rabbit holes that cannot be gone down, etc. And it'll be interesting to see the outcome of that. Josh Green is governor of Hawaii. He is also a practicing physician. He says he's seen firsthand the impact of vaccine skepticism during measles outbreaks in Samoa, which senselessly, he says, took the lives of many children. It was caused because parents did not get their children vaccinated because of fears spread by vaccine skeptics. Governor Green adds that, quote, as a rule, keeping vaccination rates above 95% can protect an entire population from infectious diseases like measles. But when vaccination rates fall, preventable diseases can regain a foothold and pose new danger. And he calls vaccines, what you have said about them, you haven't said this, moral imperatives is what he calls them. Aside from him and that group of scientists from Yale and other public health schools around the country who are worried about the appointment of Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
And RFK helped to juice the vaccine hesitancy during that outbreak. He actually visited Samoa to talk with local anti-vax activists. And you know, thousands of people in Samoa got sick, 87 people died, and it was because of a medical mistake. And I think this is one of the things that that the hesitancy really got juiced, because the way that outbreak got started was that there were two nurses who mixed the vaccine incorrectly, and it killed two children. And so then it became like this thing, and instead of sort of admitting the error, the local health department kind of doubled down. And so there's going to be required not only a level of speaking out like these physicians have done, but also a level of humility in the medical community.
My question was going to be, writing a letter, a public letter, is one thing, but if he does pose a moral and a health concern for these physicians and scientists, etc., are they willing, have you noticed anything in the zeitgeist, Rose, as a reporter, Is there a willingness among this group of individuals, people in public health, to scream from the rooftops to fight against this?
I've been trying to do a story about how public health people are preparing for the incoming Trump administration, and I am encountering a lot of people who are unwilling to go public yet. I think people are keeping their powder dry. Because they worry about things like funding their program. Like, we have an important program. I've had someone say to me, we have a really important program. I don't want to jeopardize the funding for that program by going public right now. So I think that that's very much an issue.
Once again, the governor of Hawaii, Dr. Coyle, Governor Green, says vaccinations are one of the greatest public health achievements in human history. They've saved more than 150 million lives over the past 50 years and cut infant mortality by 40% worldwide. Those figures clearly speak for themselves. And it is the states, not the federal government, that enforces vaccine mandates. What's in place in North Carolina, and do you see any movement in our Republican-controlled legislature to go with the flow going forward?
Well, we still have vaccines are required, as I said, for starting school. And so I haven't seen any changes in those laws yet. I do want to highlight something you just said. When you look at the CDC published a number of years ago, what are the top 10 major accomplishments of public health in the last century? And vaccines were at the head of the list. Like, we have saved more lives. We have kept people healthy through vaccines. And so I think you still have, you know, public health understands, those of us in public health, we understand how critical it is to keep fighting the fight of educating and promoting vaccines in our communities. And we're certainly going to keep doing that as part of our public health mission.
One of the of diseases that have been relatively, eradicated has been whooping cough, pertussis. And people don't know what it did to children back in the day. But it has been described as a painful, full-body, 100-day cough that can result in cracked ribs and difficulty breathing. That's just some of the problems there. Once again, Dr. Westner, the governor, the doctor, Joshua Green out in Hawaii, says evidence for vaccine safety is overwhelming, as is their record for saving lives. For those who believe otherwise, why are they safe and should they be mandated for children attending schools?
Yeah, I think they are safe and they should be mandated. We talked earlier in the show about the having most of the population vaccinated is protective for people who can't be vaccinated. In terms of the safety, if you look at the Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna, their initial reports on the COVID vaccines, I mean, they each had 40,000 some people in their trials, and there were no significant differences in adverse side effects between the experimental group and the placebo group. Once those vaccines got rolled out and hundreds of thousands, millions of people were getting vaccinated, yes, there were a couple really, really rare side effects that were noticed. But by and large, there are lots and lots of data showing that these vaccines are immensely safe.
So what's the best way to get the public to trust the science again?
Yeah, again, I think it's communication. I think scientists, public health experts, just have not done a good enough job communicating that information. And we've been outshouted by the minority of people who are taking an opposing viewpoint on that.
And won't you continue to be, given the fact that they control the levers of power and they now, false information can now run rampant on social media platforms? Won't you lose this battle?
I hope not. I'm not willing to take a pessimistic view of it like that, but I think it is going to be an uphill battle.
So I have less than a minute left here, Dr. Coyle. Aside from vaccines for the viruses, which have the vaccines in place for them, what's the best way to protect yourself from flu, from COVID, from RSV, from all the things that we have been talking about today?
So vaccines, number one, where they exist, but then also some basic hygiene measures like washing your hands frequently. Masks have been shown to be effective. So if you, especially if you have an immunocompromising condition, consider wearing a mask during these times when the viruses are really spreading out there. Stay home. If you are sick, stay home. Really important.
Dr. Bonnie Coyle is medical director for Mecklenburg County. Dr. David Wessner is professor of biology at Davidson College, who's done deep dives into viruses and vaccines. And Rose Hoban is founder and editor for North Carolina Health News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. We have production help from Gene Davis, Chris Jones, and Jesse Steinmetz. For information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.